Next case is 03-1351, Heritage Insurance Company versus Ohio Department of Transportation. Mr. Cole. Mr. Cole, you may begin.
Chief Justice Moyer, may it please the court, I'm Douglas Cole on behalf of the Ohio Department of Transportation. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, this case turns entirely on two well-established propositions of law that, taken together, lead inexorably to the conclusion that Heritage cannot recover here. First, under 2743.02d, a claimant against the state will have his claim reduced by the amount of any recovery he receives from a collateral source. That is, with regard to claims against the state, you can't recover what your insurer has already paid you. And second, an insurer, such as Heritage, when suing in subrogation, has no greater rights to sue a third party than its insured would have had. That is, the insurer steps into the shoes of its insured. It seems that Heritage wants to step into the shoes in order to get into court, but then remove those shoes once it's here. It can't do so. Rather, if Jurgensen sued the state for contribution, Jurgensen's recovery would have been reduced as a result of the collateral benefits that it received. In asserting Jurgensen's claim, then, Heritage is stuck with that same limitation, and that limitation forecloses any recovery here. To be sure, this rule can, at times, be hard on insurers. Insurers are sometimes left holding the bag. They pay their insureds, but they have no right to subrogation. That same fact was true, however, in community insurance. There, the insurer paid medical expenses for its insured and tried to recover from the state. This court correctly held, however, that the plain language of 2743.02d precluded any such recovery. The court noted that it was a legitimate legislative choice to leave the insurer as the payer. Insurers, after all, in the plurality opinion's words, can make actuarial computations and adjust premiums to compensate for payments to policyholders who suffer damages at the hands of, in that case, a political subdivision. The same, of course, true of a state. Indeed, if anything, it's less of a problem here than it was in community insurance, because here the insurer could have filed, in controlling the defense, could have filed a third-party complaint and removed this action to the Court of Claims. It chose not to, but that was its own choice. Only a ruling in the state's favor would be consistent with the policy goals of 2743.02 as well. Those policy goals, as this court has noted, is to ensure that uninsured victims are compensated, that is, the victims get recovery from some source, but at the same time, public resources are preserved by minimizing the claims that get passed on to state taxpayers. Here, Jurgensen, who was damaged when it was in its own, by its allegations, it was forced to pay more than its proportionate share of the damages award, has been compensated. They've received recovery from their insurer, Heritage. So there's no possibility of a victim left paying on their own, victim left without recovery. But at the same time, we want the insurer, rather than the state, to, in a sense, be the payer of last resort where there is an insurer. Here there is an insurer. It was Heritage. Heritage is left holding the bag, but that follows on straight from community insurance. To the extent that Heritage would argue that there is something different about claims for contribution, if anything, a claim for contribution is a clearer example of why this rule should apply. First, Heritage can't argue that it's a claimant separate from Jurgensen. This court, after all, in Community said, quote, Community is not a claimant separate and apart from its subrogor. The same is true of Heritage here. It's a claimant only to the extent that Jurgensen was. And there's nothing different about contribution claims. In fact, a look at the contribution statute confirms this. 230731A creates a right of contribution in tortfeasors who have paid more than their proportionate share. That is, to the extent you've been damaged by the state because the state was negligent and you've had to pay for the state's negligence, you've been damaged, you have a right of recovery, you have a claim that you can make against the state. And with respect to the insurer's right to assert that claim, we look at 2307.31c, which says that the, quote, the insurer is subrogated to the tortfeasor's right of contribution to the extent of the amount, to the extent that the amount it is paid in excess of the tortfeasor's proportionate share. That is, by statute, Heritage's claim here is one in subrogation. So it can have no greater right than Jurgensen did, but 2743.02d tells us that Jurgensen's right is subject to this collateral source setup. In fact, one of the confusing things about the other side's brief is it's not entirely clear to us whether they're arguing that Jurgensen could have recovered, notwithstanding the fact that its insurer paid it. That is, that there's something different about contribution. So Jurgensen itself could have sued the state, notwithstanding the fact it received insurance proceeds. Or whether they're saying Heritage can recover, notwithstanding that Jurgensen couldn't have. They weren't real clear on which of those two positions they're taking. Neither one of them.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding this case, but if the outcome that you advocate is the case, then why wouldn't insurance contracts, or just the way it unfolds, be in the future that Jurgensen sues the state and Heritage stays in the background, doesn't pay Jurgensen, and says, if you don't recover from the state, then we'll step up. But the state's at fault, and we're not paying because we think the state's at fault, and we don't want to put ourselves in this position.
As a practical matter, Your Honor, most insurance policies have prompt pay requirements so that it would be difficult for the insurer to just take the position, we're not going to pay at all and wait
months
and years. Well, but
insurance companies do a lot of things they're not supposed to do under their contracts.
Right. I mean, Your Honor gets to a deeper question about 2743.02d, and that is...
On house fires, they sat there and refused to pay forever, saying, you know, we think there's some arson and there's an arson clause, and eventually they may get sued for that. But so in my, I mean, why wouldn't that be the practice in the future if we hold the way you're advocating?
Well, it might well be that 2743.02d, which says recoveries against the state shall be reduced by the aggregate of insurance proceeds and a few other things, or other collateral recovery received by the claimant. If there's a clear entitlement to recovery, arguably that language could be interpreted to cover that situation as well. We don't need to get into what does received mean for purposes of this case, because
right.
Here it actually has been received.
Right. But you would acknowledge that would be a more difficult case, or if we write this case the way you'd like to have us write it, then if you're an insurance company insuring people who do a lot of business with the state, wouldn't you sit down and rewrite your policy and say, if you have a claim against the state because whatever you had to pay appears to be their fault, we only pay up after you've exhausted your remedies against the state, and if you're unsuccessful in establishing their fault, then we'll pay.
I think it's at least as likely, Your Honor, that the insurers would build it into their premiums and spread it among the risk pool of all the contractors that do a lot of business with the state. If you do a lot of business with the state, you pay a slightly higher premium to take into account this bar on risk shifting. But in the event that the policies are rewritten in the way you suggest, some judge somewhere is going to have to make a determination as to what the word receives means here. I note that the other two statutes, 2744.05, which is for political subdivisions, and 3345.40 for universities, say receive or entitled to be received, and you know, I'm not sure there's any real good reason to interpret this statute in a way that wouldn't cover a clear entitlement to be received as well. But that's an argument that's really for another day when another set of facts are presented where the insurer hasn't paid. But where the insurer has paid, you come directly and expressly within the language of 2743.02d, and I don't see any reason to let the specter.
Yeah, I'm wondering about the purpose of the statute. Wouldn't you think the purpose of the statute was to keep double recoveries from taking place and not to let the state skate off of liability when the real fault is the state's?
Well, that was the theory underlying Lumbermans, and that theory was rejected by the court and community insurance. The court and community insurance said it's twofold, compensating uninsured victims and also preventing double recovery, but at the same time, preserving public resources by saying, look, if there's an insurer here, if there's already a risk spreader involved, somebody who's got a big risk pool that they're allocating premiums over, if they've already paid so we don't have this risk concentrated on a single victim, then we want to leave the risk with that risk pool. If it's concentrated on a single victim, yeah, we'll take it to the state because the state acts as a risk pooler there too.
So then they become a no-fault risk pool.
In a sense, right, those who are insured get treated differently than those who aren't insured. But that follows directly from the express language 2743.02. It contemplates that if you've received collateral recovery, you're going to be treated differently. If you have insurance, you're treated differently than if you don't have insurance. So we can have risk spread. But we've accomplished that here. It's been spread to Heritage. I mean, it's been passed to Heritage, who is a risk spreader, and thus it can be built into the premiums. There's no reason to then once again transfer it to some other risk pool, i.e. the state, and put it on the taxpayers. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Cole.
Thank you.
Mr. Carrig.
Good morning, Your Honors. Christopher W. Carrig on behalf of the Appley Heritage Insurance Company, and I'm here today on behalf of my client to urge that this court affirm the decision of the 10th District Court of Appeals, which granted or reversed the grant of summary judgment in the trial court and permitted my client to proceed against the state of Ohio in the Court of Claims in a contribution action, the purpose of which was to have the state share in a responsibility for the underlying accident which claimed the life of Thora Moore. First of all, the statute at issue here, 2743.02d, is the key to this court's analysis. And the Court of Appeals correctly found, or at least the statute initially, in general terms, permits the state to set off from any award, insurance proceeds, disability benefits, or other collateral recoveries, and it has to have been received by the claimant. Now, Heritage, in this case, stands in the shoes of its insured, John R. Jurgensen Company. John R. Jurgensen had no collateral recovery in this case. To the contrary, John R. Jurgensen was required to pay a verdict. The verdict, by virtue of an insurance contract, was paid by my client, Heritage Insurance Company, and with that contract right, then used the vehicle of the contribution statute and instituted a action in the Court of Claims against Ohio Department of Transportation. The Court of Appeals in this case correctly ruled that John R. Jurgensen nor Heritage received any other collateral benefits in this case. What happened was they actually paid, and they distinguished a community insurance case on the fact that the insured of community in that case had been injured, had incurred medical expenses of approximately $245,000. An action was then filed against ODOT in the Court of Claims.
Counsel, let me cut here. Isn't the issue here for us is how we define claimant in O2D?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And Droneger was the claimant, Droneger in Community Insurance was the claimant, the injured person. Here, obviously, the injured person is not the one seeking, or the decedent's estate is not the one seeking the claim, not the claimant, and that's, we have to decide how we define claimant, isn't that?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what's your, the Court of Appeals has an opinion that I thought was pretty persuasive, frankly, that seems to distinguish our community insurance case from this one and gives us a sort of a way to define claimant. You agree with that, or do you disagree with the Court of Appeals definition of claimant? I assume you agree.
I agree with that because the Court of Appeals correctly found that Jurgensen received no collateral recovery and that the only person who had a right to receive a collateral recovery was Thora Moore, the estate of Thora Moore, against ODOT. And they also pointed out that the statute in question, 2743.02d, was designed to present or prevent double recovery. And in this case, there is no threat of double recovery. There is, this is an insurance company standing in the shoes of its insured, attempting to require the state to pay its fair share of the Department of Transportation for its role in the underlying accident. And so I believe that the Court of Appeals got it right in its analysis, and it carefully and thoughtfully distinguished your decision in Community Insurance Company and reached the right conclusion. There has been an argument raised by the Department of Transportation about other statutes and parallel statutes, and those involve 3345.40 and 2744.05. Those statutes are different. They involve different entities. One, 3345.40, involves state universities and colleges. The other involves political subdivisions and immunity. We believe that we have distinguished those statutes, that they do not apply in this case, and that claimant in this case is the key, and Heritage nor Jurgensen is a claimant, as that term is contemplated in the statute or has how it has been interpreted by this court in the Community Insurance Company. There is a case that has been cited by the Department of Transportation, Daugherty versus Torrance, that deals with the volunteer fireman case. And the gist of that case was that which is not excluded is included. And in this case, the term claimant is modified by the claimant has to have received some recovery from some source before the state is entitled to set it off under the statute. And again, my client, Heritage Mutual Insurance Company, has paid. It stands in the shoes of its insured. It is permitted under this statute. It's not subject to this statute, which requires a set-off because there has been no recovery. We believe that the Court of Appeals in this case correctly distinguished the one case that has been relied on heavily by the Department of Transportation and found that the statute 2743.02d is not applicable to Heritage Insurance Company in this case. Your Honors, we ask that this court affirm the Court of Appeals and permit my client, Heritage Insurance Company, to proceed in a contribution claim against the Department of Transportation for its role in the underlying accident. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. Mr. Cole, you've saved about 4 minutes, a little over 4 minutes of your time. Let me ask you, I listened, of course, intently to your argument previously, and I'm not convinced that the rationale of the Court of Appeals found on page 3 and 4 of their opinion is not persuasive. It seems to me that the claimant, the word claimant in O2D is really should be confined to the persons as defined by the Court of Appeals, that it doesn't have this sort of broad application that I think you would require us to adopt. Tell me why I shouldn't follow the Court of Appeals rationale.
Well, Your Honor, the word claimant is used throughout 2743. It's a word that refers to anyone who's bringing a claim against a state. It can't be limited, as the court below suggested, to those who are physically injured. Many of the claims that are brought in the Court of Claims, after all, are for breach of contract. There isn't a physically injured person there. This entity, Jurgensen, who's the genesis for the claim here, Jurgensen had a claim in contribution, just like someone might have a claim against the state for breach of contract, or a claim against the state for negligence that led to physical injury, or a claim against the state for negligence that led to property damages. All of those are claims that can be brought against the state. And indeed, if Jurgensen were not insured, Jurgensen could bring its claim in contribution against the state, and assuming it could prove it up, show that it paid more than its proportionate share, it would be entitled to recovery. It's a claimant just like every other claimant who comes to the Court of Claims. Breach of contract, property damage, physical injury, contribution, they're all merely claims against the state. Now, what makes Jurgensen different here is that they had an insurer. And once they have an insurer who's paid their damages, then they aren't entitled to recover them from the state, just like this court said in community insurance. There's no reason to treat Jurgensen differently just because its claim is contribution. Would that mean that someone who's, you know, if they're not a claimant, what are they? How do they have a right to bring a claim in the Court of Claims against the state? They have to have some basis, and their basis is contribution. But that's a claim just like any other claim. In fact, what Heritage argues here would result in a somewhat anomalous situation. Insurers who insure joint tortfeasors with the state would be treated better than insurers who insure innocent victims of the state's negligence. That is, in community insurance, this court said, well, community, I understand that you insured an innocent victim and you had to pay money and that it was 100% the state's fault and their fair share would be 100%, but because of 2743.02d, you recover nothing. Whereas here, the state is only alleged to be proportionally at fault. So at most, the insurer would have the right to shift some proportion of the damages award to the state. Yet going the other way here would mean that type of insurer, where it's a joint defendant with the state, is treated better, is allowed to recover, even though someone, when the state's 100% at fault and is the only defendant in the case, those insurers, it's well settled under community, can't recover. So I don't quite see why we would treat these insurers better, given that they've insured someone who's also at fault in the underlying conduct that resulted in the damage here to Ms. Moore. So I guess I have a hard time seeing why Jurgensen's not a claimant or why we would treat an insurer of a jointly negligent claimant better than we'd treat an insurer where the victim is truly innocent. The bottom line here, from the state's perspective, is that Jurgensen was allegedly damaged. Heritage paid that damage on behalf of Jurgensen, and thus Jurgensen's right to recover is reduced as a result of that. And Heritage, standing in Jurgensen's shoes, which is all it can do, is similarly limited in its right to recover. For all those reasons, as well as the reasons stated in our brief, we urge this court to reverse the decision below and implement community insurance according to its plain language.
Thank you, Mr. Cole. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.